British long jumper Greg Rutherford has won everything in his field, including World, Commonwealth, European titles. But it was his gold at the 2012 Olympic Games in London which thrust him into the spotlight, and he's been there ever since. In a wide-ranging interview, I spoke to him about recent criticism from Carl Lewis, doping, dealing with online trolls, and his use of DNA testing to improve performance. He starts by telling me what it's like to break records.
It's a funny one. I think all athletes are never truly happy with a performance, because there's always something you'll look at and you think, oh, it could have been better. I could have jumped further, thrown further, run faster, whatever it might be. So I think what you tend to do when you do it, you sort of go, okay, this is great. I'm pleased that I've achieved something which is one of the best in the country ever. But equally, I always want to sort of push on and perform even better. So when I jumped the indoor national record, it was great, but only took two jumps. And then I sort of called it quits, and I was hoping to have jumped a couple more times indoors, but alas, it wasn't to be due to a couple of injuries. But it's a good feeling. Like, obviously, it's showing that your training's going well and everything's on the right path. So I think that's very important, especially in an Olympic year.
So are you the type of guy beats yourself up as soon as you've achieved something that's never good enough?
I don't know if I beat myself up as such, but no, we always analyse and we look back and figure out what could be better. Because ultimately, in an event like athletics, you are competing against sort of the rest of the world, if you like, in the event that there's no country that isn't particularly involved with it. So there's always going to be some great people out there who are going to be challenging, no matter what you put out there. So if you look for ways to improve, it means that you can obviously improve, get better, and then the likelihood of being beaten, it lessens slightly. So from that point of view, I think it is very important to assess and accept the good things, but equally always aim to improve.
And I guess no point beating yourself up, because others will do that for you, won't they?
You've
got the likes of Carl Lewis, of course, describing your jump as pathetic.
I mean, it's one of those funny ones. I was made aware of the statements and everything else. And for me, things that someone like Carl Lewis says, it isn't important. Ultimately, for me, it's about improving and doing as well as I possibly can do. And actually, do you know what? It's about having the people around me being proud of what I do and what I achieve. I've never jumped to impress ex-athletes and people like that. That's never bothered me at all.
But so why do you think, he's a four-time Olympic champion, isn't he? So why do you think he would do that? He knows when he says it, it's going to be picked up. He knows it's going to be published. Why would he do that?
Do you know what? I don't particularly know. I've not had that many conversations with Carl, so I don't really know. I think he's been known to make the odd outlandish statement in the past, and possibly he was just doing the same again. But as I say, for me, it's not something that really enters my head, to be totally honest. There's a lot more worries in my life, like going on and trying to defend an Olympic title. So I'm not too concerned. I can ultimately only beat who's in front of me and jump as far as my body will allow me to go. So that's basically how I see it.
And how far your body will allow you to go, of course, is at the core of what I want to talk to you about, the use of DNA to improve performance. And this is this DNA fit test. What is it?
Basically, it's a test you can take. It's a swab which you wipe around your mouth, you put into a tube and it's sent off, and you get back information about nutrition and your body and how it reacts to certain modes of training and everything else. So for me, it was a fascinating sort of experiment, I guess. I'd always done things probably slightly different to how other people had deemed athletics to be performed. So I do a lot of things like running hills and sort of maybe larger amounts of reps in the gym at times. And some people would say, oh, no, you shouldn't be doing that. That's not right. And I was a massive advocate for rest after training. And funnily enough, we then sort of tested the DNA and it came back with sort of all the things that I'd always thought, which I think is hugely important. Now, it's not a tool for determining what you can do and everything else. What it basically does is it sort of helps reinforce thought process and help guide, I guess, slightly on the way where you may not know.
So what it does is it screens, I'm reading about it as we speak, it screens 45 gene variants scientifically linked to the body's response to training and nutrition.
Yeah.
And therefore, you are able to tell, am I reading this right, you're able to tell then what type of training is best for you. Is that it?
Well, basically, it helps you make better decisions. That's the most important thing from it. Ultimately, if, for example, if with the nutrition side of things, say it showed that you had a high susceptibility to gaining weight from carbohydrates, then ultimately you want to lessen the amount of carbohydrates going into your system, because genetically you are predisposed to putting on weight that way. Same with training. For example, if it shows that your body is made up of more, say, endurance-based work, then ultimately going out and trying to do short sprint-based workouts probably isn't the best to maximize your body. So from that point of view, it helps you make clear, informed decisions based upon actually what your DNA makeup is showing you.
Well, what were you predisposed to? What's your body made up of?
It was quite interesting, actually. I'm a speed power based athlete, so which we know I do that sort of event. But what it actually showed as well is that I have a level of endurance in me, which I never really realized. But actually, it makes sense. As I say, with things like running hill reps, I do a lot of that, and then I go in the gym and I may lift for quite long periods of time. Whereas others may, I don't know, just do three or four. I may be in there for 10 to 15 plus reps of a certain weight. And I felt that that's always helped me, but arguably some people would train very, very differently. So that basically reinforced the processes that I was doing, and showed genetically that, yeah, do you know what? I have the ability to have a bit more of endurance-based work in my workout.
You have a high sensitivity to refined carbohydrates, don't we all?
Yes, sadly. Yeah, this is something that we definitely did already realise. My body doesn't react well. I have to work incredibly hard and eat it very, very strictly in order to stay in good shape. And what we have found in the off season is a great example. I put on weight so fast, it's unreal, and I lose sort of the definition and everything else that I have while I'm training. And funnily enough, when we saw it, it was the inevitable. We knew it was coming, but then it said it there in black and white again. Yes, you are susceptible to putting on weight if you eat lots of carbohydrates, which was quite interesting. Funnily enough, I also have that slightly with the fat gene as well. So I, as much as protein and fats is quite high in my diet, thankfully, I've managed to live without carbohydrates, so it hasn't affected me too much.
So you can have a fat.
But it is fascinating.
You have a fat gene, do you? I know we all have a fat gene, but you've got a fat gene that's even it's appealing to fat even more than other people, is it?
Well, it's not as black and white as that, but it's basically, yeah, you can sort of break down certain things and see what you have higher risk and susceptibility to. But again, from the sort of the real in depth of it, the experts are the better ones of explaining each gene. But it's it is fascinating when you get the report back and you can see quite clearly what you have a higher sort of level of resistance to and what you don't, and it's fascinating to see.
Well, there was an independent study into this. It was peer-reviewed. It was published in the Biology of Sport. And what they reckon it shows is those who trained, and this is what I find fascinating, those who trained to their genetic makeup improved their athletic performance almost three times more than those on mismatched training programs.
Yeah, this was amazing. This was sort of based out of the gym, so it's more sort of gym workout as opposed to sort of running on a track or anything else. But it showed if you work to what your genetics are showing you from a DNA fit test, then there is a much better improvement. I mean, three times is quite a large amount. So from that point of view, it shows that actually following what your makeup is saying is a good path to go down.
And you'll be aware of the controversy around this. 2014 Man United, for example, they ruled out commissioning genetic profiles of their players, didn't they, on ethical grounds. They don't think it's right. For example, people could have a genetic makeup, athletes could have a genetic makeup to being more injury prone than others, and then all of a sudden your value as possibly a footballer, different athlete, it falls. And with that information, clubs could be starting to very much discriminate against different human beings based on their personal genetic makeup. That's the controversy, isn't it?
Yeah, from that point of view, what you can't say is if you take a DNA fit test that determines what path you will take. I mean, you've got to think of it this way. if I'd never seen a track and never been to a long jump pit before, then I still wouldn't be a long jumper. And equally, you can't turn around, you can't sort of look at it and say, well, you have the genes there, you're definitely going to be a long jumper. Sort of the gene that determines speed and power, there's something like 99% of all sprinters have that gene. But equally, 20% of people who have never been an Olympic sprinter or anything else around that still have that same gene. Equally, it's part of your makeup and it's how it's interpreted rather than being obviously a determining factor. So, more data is obviously needed in the long run for like 100% definitive on absolutely everything. But this is one part of, I think, a training program which can help and be aligned to a lot of other things which obviously you need to succeed.
Are you, Greg, the first Olympic champion in the world to have this profile done?
As far as I know, I mean, it is open. I mean, there are other sports people and that have done it. But to my knowledge, yeah, I don't think anybody else has gone down this route yet and had theirs checked. So from that point of view, yeah, it is. It's very interesting. I'll tell you what, it would also be very interesting to see what the other athletes have, because ultimately it's building up a profile and giving more data to build up an idea of what is needed and what is involved in becoming a long jumper, I guess, in that way.
Yeah, the elite level that you're at the very top, in other words, the margins are so slim, aren't they?
Yes, they are. It's one of those interesting things. I mean, we always say it within the sport, when you're in your fittest, you're on the always on the cusp, it seems, of an injury, because you've got your body into such good shape that is sort of an inevitability of training. And at the very, very top, I would imagine a lot of people have a lot of similarities. And then it is down to taking the best ethical routes you possibly can to train to your best and fulfill your potential. Mm. And that's obviously what this also helps you do.
It's also a lot of pressure, isn't it? That if the margins are so slim, how do you make yourself that nth degree better? And I guess that's where the temptation for some athletes comes in to dope themselves.
Yeah, sadly, over the years we've obviously had some bad things come out with it, especially within athletics recently, and it is incredibly disappointing. And do you know what? I think a lot of athletes take the easy option, that they do the silly things because it seems to come to them easier. For example, I moved myself, my family out here to Arizona for 4 months of the year. I seek out the very best coach there is in Dan Path, the guy who looks after me. And you have to make quite a few sacrifices in order to do well. But for others, sadly, they see it as, you know, I can get a quick fix by doing something, well, yeah, completely unethical and wrong. And sadly, that's the world that we live in. And hopefully, with the change in the IAAF, WADA and everything else, we can actually start getting rid of not just the individuals, but equally the systems that have been set in place by certain countries, it seems, to create this sort of doping culture, which for clean athletes, believe me, is exceptionally hard for us to take at times. I've lost out on earnings and other things due to dopers, and you never get that back. That's the way it is.
Have you ever been tempted?
Absolutely not, no. Do you know the one thing that I've always thought, no matter what happens, no matter what other people say, the likes of Carl Lewis and whatever else, when I retire, when I hang up my spikes, I can look at myself in the mirror and I can say, at least I maximised the potential I had. And then when I'm talking to my kids, I've only got one at the moment, but hopefully more in the future, I can look them in the face and say, and say that, do you know what? A random kid from Bletchley can actually do pretty well if you've got the right genes and the right training environment. And I think that's what's more important than ever doing anything stupid.
So in your own gut and your own head, how do you feel about those who do cheat?
Oh, for me, it's very, very tough. I think they should be banned for life. I've always been an advocate for lifetime bans. If that's not going to come in, as it hasn't yet, then you should 100% be banned from the major competitions, be that the World Championships, Olympics, Europeans, everything else. Because for a lot of athletes, that's actually how you earn a large amount of money. If you can win medals at these things, you can have a better earning. So you remove that, and then I would like to believe the temptation would go down. because it isn't fair. And there's so many people, you absolutely give it everything you possibly can, as I say, to maximise your body's potential. And then when somebody else takes a shortcut, it's a very bitter pill to swallow. So
why do you think, Greg, that lifetime ban isn't there automatically? Why wouldn't that be sensible? Or why haven't they done it is a better question.
I'm not too sure why they haven't done it. It always seems to be when it's sort of implemented, then legally things seem to change. Lawyers come in and things get overturned and whatever else, which is a bizarre scenario. But I think the athletes, definitely the clean athletes, we all say, yeah, ban them for life. But then obviously there's other people that don't have the same view. Ultimately, I'm responsible for everything I put in my body. If I end up failing a test, that's my fault. And that's because I've put something tainted in or I've actively tried to cheat. And that's the same for everybody in the world. So if you've done that, you've wronged the sport and you've wronged all your competitors and everybody else. There should be a major punishment for it. And sadly, there isn't as it stands.
We found out this week athletes caught using meldonium, and the most famous of those to be banned being Maria Sharapova. What are your thoughts on that?
To be honest, again, I'd never heard of the drug until it all came out in the press about Maria. Again, I don't know. There's clearly these grey areas where people work, and it's one day it's not banned, the next day it is, and that's a difficult one, because arguably if you're on some form of prescription and you're ill, whatever else, and you're given it and then you fail, then I guess that's a slightly clouded area. But I mean, I don't know enough about the drug. I know nothing about the drug, actually, what it does for you. So if it's like a major steroid, then obviously you shouldn't be taking it. Nobody should be taking it. So in that instance, it's such a strange place to be. But ultimately, if Sharapova's attempted to cheat, then she should be banned.
You mentioned money earlier on. How difficult is it at your level to get the funding? Because you've been critical about this. There was a Guardian article, I think you wrote last year, about the funding you receive.
Yeah, I mentioned, obviously, I'd had a few issues, to say the least. And that's something that I think a lot of athletes have experienced at times in their career. The funding system's a very interesting one. But, I mean, it is obviously a fantastic one to a certain degree, because it helps a lot of athletes have the potential to train rather than having to work full time. It's something that, yeah, ultimately it's to make you a better athlete. And it works for most people. I mean, it was great for me in the build up to the Olympics. But there's certain things in place which mean that doesn't always carry on. And it can also cause a few issues in certain sports because of that reason, because people are means tested out of certain things. And then if your governing body isn't supporting you in the right way, then it can become very awkward. And that was a position I found myself in last year, and a position, thankfully, now that's been rectified, and we're working together to actually, yeah, maximise and hopefully bring me to winning another Olympic gold medal.
But you wouldn't have found it tight at any stage. You know, you can put food on the table, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, it's not like I'm living off it. I mean, there's been some circumstances in my life at times where it's been very, very awkward. And that does happen to certain athletes.
In what way?
Quite a funny anecdote. I mean, just before the Olympics, literally the day of my qualification, I rang up my best friend and sort of sat on the phone and was like, I've gone into an overdraft that I don't have in my account. I'm overdrawn. Is that going to affect my credit rating? And that's where I was the day before I jumped at the Olympics. The one thing I've always believed is that you have to invest heavily into your own career in order to succeed. And every year I was paying for flying overseas, staying in certain places, training in warm weather and everything else. Certain parts of it are covered, other parts it's down to yourself. And if you're not prepared to make those sacrifices, then ultimately you can't come away and win things, I believe. And again, in athletics, it massively depends on what event you do, everything else within sort of how much you can earn from the sport, if you like.
Yeah,
there isn't a clear tier system or everything else. It's just purely depending on you and your event, I guess.
I wonder if a boy like you is secretly envious of someone like Mo Farah, Jessica Hill and the big bucks that they can get?
No, Envy, do you know what? Envy would never enter my thought process in that way, because ultimately, if I wouldn't have been part of what was, I think, pretty incredible Saturday night in August 2012, then I wouldn't be in the position that I'm in now anyway. So from that point of view, what it does is it promotes our sport in such a way that more people want to come into the sport and more youngsters want to perform and get involved. And I think that's incredibly important. The fact that I may not earn as much as other people doesn't matter, because I still earn enough to live and have a half-decent lifestyle. So from that point of view, that would never enter my thought process.
This is the first time I've ever spoken to you in my life. And I get the impression, Greg, from this interview that you very much can shut out the outside world and focus on what you want to achieve. And, you know, you're suggesting when you get some flack from some of these other athletes, you can shut that out. But then, of course, you're quite outspoken and you engage in Twitter. You react to people. I get abuse on Twitter every single day of the week, for goodness sake, right? But you react. Why?
I think everybody has a boiling point. And certain subjects and other things and certain things are said, I think it's only human that eventually you respond. I was a lot more fiery a few years ago, for sure, and I was a lot more reactive then. And I've learnt now to sort of rein that in a little bit more, just because it's wasted energy. When it comes to jumping and everything else, I've like to think I'm one of the best in the world at being able to actually switch off and think about purely what I need to do, which is jumping far. And as soon as I walk into a stadium, my mindset changes, my emotion changes, and it's ready to go. Sometimes in the sort of the general world, when you're sitting at home and you're at a computer or checking on your phone or something else, and something pretty nasty has been said to you, if it's the wrong tone or maybe catches you at the wrong time, I can react to that. And that's, as I say, I think that's a natural part of being a human at times. Sometimes you just, somebody says something, it rubs you up the wrong way and you react to it.
The nastiest territory? I'm not asking you to repeat it, because then that's doing their job for them. But what's the nastiest territory they get into about you that really sends you over the edge?
I'd rather not really give it any props. I mean, when things are said about your family, that's, I think, when it starts to boil over slightly. And that's where what's featured before. And I think that's probably where I've been my most reactive, I think that anybody would react to that.
Let me round this interview off with this. Tell me about your dreams of what you want to achieve in the future, both professionally and what you do for a living, and personally as an individual. What are your dreams, your aspirations?
Ultimately, when my career is over, and hopefully it will continue to be a very successful career, hopefully it doesn't sound too soppy or whatever else, but I love being a dad more than anything. And if I can continue, hopefully, being a good dad, provide and do everything in order to make my children proud, then I think that's a pretty successful life as it stands.
I'm not a dad. What's it feel like to be a dad? Greg, can you put words to it?
No, it's very, very difficult to. My son's 18 months old now, so he's really turning into a little human that's sort of interacting a lot more, and I can have a hell of a lot more fun with him now. It's pretty magical, I'm not going to lie. I come home from training, and ultimately Milo doesn't mind if I've had a bad session or if something's gone wrong or whatever else. He just wants to play, and he's always really happy to see me. And that's a lovely alternative to coming home and then dwelling on bad things. So, for me, that is and always will be the most important thing.
Pleasure to talk to you, Greg. Thank you so much.
And I appreciate that.
All the best.
All the best. Bye-bye.